Welcome. This is the virtual version of the International Conference of Secular AA, December 5th, 2020. Our first Zoom International Conference. This was our first speaker. Dr. George Koob is talking about alcohol use disorder in the time of COVID-19 and the challenges for AA. Dr. Koob is the director of the National Institute for Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, NIAAA. He's an internationally renowned expert on alcohol and stress and the neurobiology of alcohol and drug addiction. Find out more about NIAAA at www.niaaa.nih.gov. Here we go, about 2 minutes in to ICSA 2020.
Recovery from alcohol use disorder is attainable and often includes relapse as part of the process. The conceptual framework I've illustrated here basically is an argument that there are different stages. They're color-coded with the brain regions that are responsible for those different stages and the functional domains that are disrupted. So in the binge intoxication stage, it's incentive salience and pathological habits. And of course, the blue there is the basal ganglia, where these deficits are mediated. For the negative affect withdrawal stage, you have reward deficits and a stress surfeit, and that's the extended amygdala there in red, deep inside the brain. And then, you know, the craving stage or the preoccupation anticipation stage where we have executive function deficits, and that's mediated by largely cortical and allocortical structures. But you can see, you don't have to be a neuroanatomist to see that this is largely cortical in the green. And this has provided us with a way to really make significant advances in understanding, you know, targets for treatment, behavioral treatments, and where they work, and when people are actually afflicted and how severely and when they will have recovered, we hope, in the future. So here's some things that we've accomplished in epidemiological research has enabled us to track progress and challenges associated with alcohol misuse in the United States. Advances in understanding the genetics of alcohol use disorder have implications for prevention and precision medicine. Research has established that the adolescent brain is uniquely vulnerable to the effects of alcohol. Longitudinal studies that assess predictors and consequences of adolescent alcohol consumption continue to inform prevention and treatment strategies. Understanding the role of stress neurobiology in alcohol misuse has implications for risk and recovery from AUD. There's a menu of effective behavioral therapies for treatment of AUD. There are currently 3 FDA-approved effective medications for treatment of AUD. Recognized by researchers in the 1970s, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder has been a longstanding research priority for NIAAA with significant advances now in diagnosis and someday we hope in treatment and prevention. And then as alcohol-associated liver disease contributes to increasing alcohol-related mortality, treatment remains an unmet clinical need, but something we are researching. Alcohol and, current challenges and priorities include mental health conditions. Alcohol misuse often precedes diagnosis of mental health problems in an effort to cope with some of the stress that exacerbates one and the other. Acute alcohol at binge levels may reduce pain, but chronic alcohol and withdrawal increase pain sensitivity. Disrupted sleep, persistent sleep problems during abstinence promote relapse and are a major impediment for recovery from alcohol use disorder. And then we have emerging trends in alcohol use in the population. Alcohol use among women, gender gaps are narrowing for prevalence, early onset drinking, frequency and intensity of drinking, having an alcohol use disorder, and many negative consequences of alcohol misuse. And increasing alcohol use among senior adults, is an issue. This is my generation's cohort, and 1 in 10 individuals in this aged cohort are engaging in binge drinking. And to focus a little bit on the mental health issue. Alcohol misuse correlates with poor mental health. It often precedes diagnoses of mental health conditions. It's commonly used in an effort to cope with symptoms. In the end, it makes the prognoses worse. Similarly, mental health conditions complicate treatment for alcohol use disorder. This caption says, I'm right here in the room and no one even acknowledges me. Paul Sommergaard, when he was president of APA and did his plenary address, and we were responsible for the NIH component of the American Psychiatric Association meeting that year, Paul said, if you've never seen alcohol use disorder in your practice, you're delusional. And, you know, one of our biggest goals, and this is something we expect that you all will be helping us with, is that it's closing the treatment gap. In the U.S., fewer than 10% of people with alcohol use disorder receive any form of treatment. Routine healthcare presents a unique opportunity for prevention, early intervention, and treatment of alcohol use disorder. However, many healthcare providers do not perform alcohol screening, are not aware of evidence-based treatments, do not know where to refer patients for treatment. So our goals are to improve physician training in substance use prevention and treatment at all levels and integrate prevention, early intervention, and treatment into routine healthcare. One of the things that we're going to be doing in this regard is developing a clinician's core resource. And when I define clinician here, I'm referring to everyone from a pharmacist to a nurse practitioner to a physician's assistant to a primary care doctor to a board certified addiction medicine specialist. And, you know, we are nearing the end of our efforts in this, and we'll be getting this out to a focus group soon. But the modules will include everything from prevention and primary care, the role of common co-occurring conditions, neuroscience, diagnostic criteria, evidence-based therapies and medications, addressing stigma, and interactions with commonly used medications. And then to support research on recovery, for consistency across recovery research studies, in addition, NIAAA has engaged stakeholders to develop a consensus research, I emphasize that definition of recovery. The proposed definition describes recovery as a process through which an individual pursues both remission from AUD and cessation of heavy drinking. So these are some of the things that we're currently working on. I want to kind of wrap up by telling you about alcohol as a coping response. I call this hypercatechia. I'll tell you about that later, deaths of despair and COVID-19. You know, pre-pandemic, alcohol-related deaths doubled from 1999 to 2017. The death rates were highest among men and middle-aged and older adults. The death rates increased over time across all age groups, except for 16 to 20 and 75 and older, and the increase in death rate was greater in women than men. These statistics align with other recent reports that have highlighted changing trends in drinking patterns and increased consequences of alcohol in women and the aging population, as I alluded to earlier. Alcohol plays a prominent role in the deaths of despair, a term coined by Angus Deaton and Anne Case to reflect the factors that are resulting in increased mortality in the United States. This is all pre-pandemic, I might add, as opposed to other Western countries where there's been a significant and straight line decrease in mortality over the last 20 years. And so what are the three factors that contribute to these deaths of despair? Well, they're in the graph and the diagram on the right, but drug overdoses, suicides, and liver disease I've already mentioned, and alcohol plays a role in each one of those. And these patterns of increased mortality have been observed across many racial and ethnic groups and age groups now in more recent studies. And I just want to show you that to loop back to the mental health part, any mental illness in the past year among adults age 18 or older have been steadily increasing in from 2008 to 2019. And you can see these numbers and the graph. This comes from SAMHSA. And the difference between the estimate and the 2019 estimate, this estimate in 2019 is statistically significant. So there is a significant increase in any mental illness, and this goes with depression as well. I'm not showing any of those slides, but I just want you to realize that we have multiple things that were going on even pre-pandemic. And then we add in the pandemic and we have a bi-directional relationship of alcohol use disorder. So isolation and stress associated with the pandemic could lead to increased alcohol misuse. Physical distancing can lead to social isolation or loss of social support, which can lead to stress or precipitate relapse for those in recovery. Physical distancing also poses challenges for treatment and recovery. Telehealth and virtual meetings can be helpful options for individuals seeking treatment or in recovery from alcohol use disorder. And there are also biological and behavioral issues. The biological and behavioral effects of alcohol misuse could also exacerbate the pandemic. Alcohol produces behavioral disinhibition. I'm sure you're all familiar with that, and may promote risky behavior and less compliance with guidelines to reduce the spread of the virus. A person, you know, alcohol is the social lubricant of our society, but being in an enclosed space, taking off your mask, bellowing in front of the person in front of you, showing disinhibited behavior, you know, all the things that you're familiar with that alcohol does is in low doses may indeed be helping spread the virus. And then alcohol compromises immune function. I'm not going to go into this in great detail, but alcohol is much more represented in acute respiratory distress syndrome pre-pandemic. We know that acute respiratory distress syndrome is a significant part of the severe pathology associated with hospitalization with COVID-19. The cytokine surge that you see in COVID-19 is very similar to the cytokine surge you see in ARDS, which is exacerbated by alcohol misuse. So you get the picture. So, you know, the diagram on the right here that I've shown now, both slides, indicates that there are multiple ways through behavior and also direct biological effects that misuse of alcohol can exacerbate the pandemic, and the pandemic can exacerbate alcohol misuse. And just for a little more concrete data, surveys of consumers in the United States and elsewhere suggest that some people are drinking more while others are drinking less. For those that may be consuming more alcohol, limited data suggests that stress, which is one of my favorite topics, is a contributing factor. For instance, alcohol use increased among college students in March, particularly among those reporting higher levels of stress and anxiety. People who said their psychological well-being was impacted negatively by the pandemic also reported more drinking days and more drinks per occasion. An Australian study found that 20% of people reported drinking more during the pandemic, and about half of those endorsed stress, anxiety, boredom, or worry that COVID-19 as reasons for drinking more. Such findings are concerning given that drinking to cope places a person on a slippery slope to alcohol use disorder. It's a form of misregulation. If you're drinking alcohol to reduce your stress, when the alcohol wears off, your stress is increased even more. And so you get into this vicious cycle of trying to fix the problem with the element that's actually causing the problem or making it worse. And then in addition, increases in consumption can increase the risk of injuries at a time when many hospitals are inundated with sick patients. And finally, it's not on this slide, but we know that that in a few of these studies, women seem to be drinking more than men, or increasing the drinking more than men during the pandemic. I wanted to give a shout out to Alcoholics Anonymous and other 12-step programs. I just wanted to show you that I showed this slide at our National Advisory Council meeting a few months ago. A systemic review, which is listed below and published in the Cochrane Database Systems Review by Kelly Humphreys and Ferrari, examined outcomes of 10,000 participants from 27 studies. You know, the problem I have is that the Zoom blocks out part of my actual texts here, so it makes it hard to read. And I never figured out, all right, studies that compared peer-led Alcoholics Anonymous or professionally delivered 12-step programs with other behavioral interventions such as motivational enhancement therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy, 12-step facilitation treatment variants, or no treatment. So in other words, it was a comparison of standard behavioral treatments, but also with a variety of different 12-step facilitations across a variety of measures, AA performed at least as well as other behavioral treatments for AUD, and AA was more effective in increasing abstinence, which should be no surprise to you all, and I've circled that in red there. These results suggest that AA and 12-step facilitation can offer a low-cost, effective treatment option for maintaining abstinence among those with alcohol use disorder. And I would submit that I think I'm preaching to the choir here, but I just wanted to show you this is actually a very nice scientific review. So to summarize, you know, addiction can be misuse or misregulation as a coping response. And we call this negative emotional state that's associated with withdrawal from alcohol. It's, you know, hyperkatephia. And you'll say, well, what on earth is that? Well, it's a word I made up. And it's supposed to be analogous to hyperalgesia. So what is hyperalgesia? Well, hyperalgesia is well known to be increased pain when a pain relief medication wears off. And it's now been well documented with opiates and alcohol, I might add, because alcohol relieves pain too, unfortunately at very high doses. So I wanted a word to describe hypersensitive negative emotional state. So I invented hyperkatephia, which is, the katephia is Greek for sadness or dejection or negative emotional state. And our argument is that this contributes to the withdrawal negative affect stage and of course has loading from a number of things that we consider allostatic loads. And so the argument is that on the top there, you see, you know, that normal hedonic tone is maintained when you're not overusing a drug or alcohol in particular. And that's a return to homeostasis. But on the other hand, we know that there is a shift in that hedonic tone to ever negative state. And it's weighted down by genetics and epigenetics, childhood trauma, psychiatric comorbidity, and excessive drinking. And that's the basically where we believe this allostatic load is focusing on the negative affect stage of the addiction cycle. I want to end by mentioning that NIAAA is committed to supporting a diverse research community and research on health disparities. Health disparities are highlighted by the COVID-19 pandemic and recent instances of social injustice with African Americans are a call to action for NIH and the entire scientific community. NIAAA recognizes that diverse research teams broaden the scope of scientific inquiry, bring creative solutions to bear on complex scientific problems, and encourage research relevant to the healthcare needs of underserved populations. To eliminate health disparities and diversify the scientific workforce, NIAAA is committed to significantly increasing diversity and fully embracing inclusion in the scientific workforce, eliminating health disparities and funding among grantees from underrepresented groups, expanding health disparities research, and ensuring that our research and outreach benefits underserved communities. You know, I want to mention that, you know, at the end, I mean, I sort of made it in the title, Challenges for Alcoholics Anonymous in the Pandemic and Post-Pandemic. And rigorous reviews of research on the mechanisms of behavior change through which Alcohol Anonymous enhances recovery have found that AA typically confers benefits by mobilizing multiple therapeutic factors simultaneously, mostly through facilitating adaptive changes in social networks of participants, but also by boosting members' recovery coping skills, recovery motivation, abstinence, self-efficacy, and psychological well-being by reducing impulsivity and craving. And this is a quote from John Kelly in 2020. So some of the areas that I think are important for you all are lack of direct social interaction produces unique challenges across the board for treatment of those struggling with AUD. Meetings are a cornerstone of AA, of course. Can online AA meetings provide the same social support as in-person meetings? How important is the physical and social context? I'm assuming you all are working on that, but we could actually use some research in this domain. Diversity issues are and will remain a challenge in alcohol treatment. Availability, stigma, research, and public health during the pandemic and post-pandemic. How do online meetings impact diversity? So, I'm going to totally end now by, you know, letting you know we have a lot of publications. We have two really important websites, Rethinking Drinking and the NIAAA Treatment Navigator. I'm happy to explain them in more detail. And you can help us spread the word of our 50th anniversary celebration on social media. Our website has been updated. It's a living document. So if you think there are things missing, you should let us know. And I want to just thank you all for listening. I guess that's a sort of pun intended. And a special thanks to Rachel Anderson and Aaron White, who helped me with these slides and some of the conceptual framework. So I'm going to stop there. I'll be happy to answer any questions that anybody might have. And I think I'm going to stop sharing my screen.
Thank you, Dr. Kube. That was fascinating and very interesting. Several people have asked if your slides will be made available. Can we share those slides with others?
Yeah, you have them, Greg. I sent you the latest version.
Yes, I do have them. And for those of you in the room, I will share them. There are two ways to take questions and answers. One is to unmute and shout and wave your hand. Another is to use the chat feature, or you can down, if you click on the participants, you can raise your hand and ask a question there. I'll ask one question, if I may, Dr. Kube. A common topic in AA, or at least in the people I run with, is if there was a pill you could take that would kill your cravings, and you could go ahead and drink and have one drink and not be driven for more the way addictive people like me are, would you take that pill? Is a pill like that something that NIH or NIAAA is researching?
Well, Greg, in some sense, we already have it because naltrexone, which is also known, in the long-acting version is Vivitrol, it really does kind of dull the pleasurable effects of alcohol after the first drink. But it's not, it's not, first of all, it's not effective with everyone in doing that. You know, its effect size is around 0.3, same as with the Camprasate, which is used more for the craving, protracted abstinence phase. And secondly, I'm pretty sure people would try to drink past it or stop taking their pill. So I think that, you all probably wonder, well, what do we recommend at NIAAA? What we recommend is what you recommend for the most part, which is abstinence, but we'll take anything we can get along the way. That's our perspective. And, I think I would rather try to develop medications, and that's where we're putting our focus on, reestablishing that hedonic homeostasis so that there's no longer the craving or the need to drink excessively, and build with that, of course, behavioral treatments. I don't think there's ever going to be a pill to treat any mental illness that does not involve also rebuilding your life, in a sense, rebuilding your connections, rebuilding your environment, reducing your trauma, working through some of your trauma, reducing the stressors in your environment. I mean, all of those things are critical. I mean, I think you all know better than I, but I would assume you don't recommend hanging out with drinkers once you've decided that you're going to go abstinent. And, I think we have to pay attention to those issues. And so having a pill where you could just say, well, I'm going to go out and have one drink. I think it's never going to work. That's my gut reaction. I don't have any data.
I see some hands raised.
Mikey had a question.
Hey, thank you for your talk. That was absolutely fascinating. I wondered if you could answer one of the questions that's on the slide. Can online AA meetings provide the same social support as in-person meetings? And how important is the physical and social context?
Yeah, well, we don't know the answer to that. I'm kind of hoping that you all are going to find the answer to that. We do have funded studies now that are going to be looking at some of these issues. But if there is a silver lining to the pandemic, it is that hopefully clever people will come up with clever ways of making 12-step facilitation programs work better through online mechanisms. I don't know how many of you saw some of the conventions, but the political conventions, but I thought it was remarkable in some sense. And Greg was telling me that you all can now have meetings where, which is probably a better example, where there's somebody represented in virtually every state of the union. So there's some things that we might be able to do better, even more pedestrian. It turns out that now at NIH, that we're doing all our presentations and seminars and special lectures virtually. We're having double, triple, quadruple the number of individuals participate. It is more than a little challenging, is what I want to say. But I think that maybe we'll find ways of doing better cognitive behavioral therapy, doing better motivational interviewing, doing, other therapies, mindfulness through the virtual world, maybe through avatars. I don't know. You can think far out. Maybe we put on those things that put us in a three-dimensional space. I forget what they're called, but So anyway, I'm the eternal optimist, but. I think it is a challenge, and that's and the benefit post-pandemic would be we have rural communities where you probably have to drive 100 miles to find an AA meeting that fits your particular needs. And so, maybe this would be helpful for people who can't get to a doctor maybe or a meeting or a therapist. Those are my thoughts. There was one here about, can I briefly outline some of the genetic components of alcohol addiction? In particular, is there a genetic component involved in opiate, benzo, and other addictive substances? Yeah, the heritability for alcohol use disorder and other addictions is about 0.5, 0.6. And what that means is that, as Mark Schuchat would always say, there is a genetic loading, but it doesn't mean you're predestined, all right? One of the interesting things that have come out, and Mark gave a talk at our 50th anniversary symposium, but he's been following a cohort of individuals who had a family history of alcohol use disorder for now three generations. And one of the fascinating things about this cohort is that they typically have a very low response to alcohol. It's opposite of what you might think intuitively. And he calls it low sensitivity, or low response to alcohol. I call it inherent tolerance. But because of that, these individuals tend to drink more and more to try and get that initial effect. And because of that, they do a lot more damage to their brains than their bodies. And the genetics that seem to be involved in some of this is obviously, there's a good bit of data on alcohol metabolizing enzymes. So if you're Asian American and you're missing the allele for acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, or you're missing both alleles for alcohol dehydrogenase, you probably don't drink at all, because if you even take a sip, you're going to get dizzy and nauseous and so forth. And that's a very dramatic example of genetics. Other elements are some of the ones we know and love from neurobiology, the GABAergic receptor, a potassium channel that we know is particularly sensitive to alcohol. There is some of the stress neurotransmitter systems that I know and love are showing genetic loading in some subgroups of individuals. So, but one thing I can say for sure, it's not one gene. It's going to be multiple genes and multi-determined, much like depression or any other mental illness. What does an IAAA think about baclofen, which some therapists recommend for alcohol cravings? Baclofen is approved in France. The problem with baclofen is that, and I doubt it will ever get through the FDA, is that it has some pretty severe side effects if you drink with the baclofen. It's approved for spasticity and multiple sclerosis in this country, but those are probably individuals not getting behind the wheel of a car and drinking at the same time. And the one benefit that appears to be the case with baclofen is that in individuals with liver disease, it's been used in Europe as an aid because it doesn't interact with the liver and cause any problems with alcohol interactions in the liver. But I want to point out to you that neither does acamprosate get metabolized by the liver, nor gabapentin. And acamprosate is approved by the FDA for as an anti-craving medication, And gabapentin is used on the VA formulary because it certainly seems to help with protracted abstinence and sleep disturbances, and helps normalize sleep in alcohol use disorder. It's not officially approved by the FDA, but it is on the VA formulary. So that's what I know about baclofen. I mean, it was really promoted in France by Olivier Amazon, who was a physician, to Mitterrand, who was the premier of France. And so he had a lot of influence because he self-treated himself with baclofen. But I knew Olivier, he's passed on, and he took enormous doses of baclofen, okay? So I think we'd have to be careful in this country where everybody's driving. And I don't think it'll get through the FDA in its current formulation because of the side effects. Is it a good target? Maybe. There's a whole bunch of, to end on a positive note, there's a whole bunch of other medications that may hit that target that could be useful, and those are under investigation.
Thank you. Noel from London had a question.
How could Dr. Silkworth's doctor opinion be uploaded in the light of research from neuroscience? I'm not sure what Dr. Silkworth's doctor opinion is. Could you explain to me, Noel?
Hi, Dr. Cobb. It's the Dr. Silkworth, as far as I can tell, qualified, you know, got medically qualified as a physician in 1900. And that's kind of the Bible in the 12 by in the big book about how, what the nature of the illness is. But we've had, you know, whatever it is, 120 years of, you know, recent neuroscience and more extensive use of cognitive therapy. So I guess it's maybe a slight tangent to what you're talking about, but I just wondered if you had any thoughts on recent neuroscience and research that could imply how that doctor's opinion, Joe might be able to better explain exactly what the doctor's opinion says, and in the light of that research, how could it possibly be updated?
Thanks, Noel. Yeah, it was the allergy theory, the theory of alcoholism being an allergy back in 1935.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think you could broaden it and make it more generalizable today that the allergy is many of the allostatic loads that I indicated there. So some people may have been abused as children and had childhood trauma. Some people may have a genetic loading. Maybe they were born with too much of stress hormones in their brain. I mean, heaven forbid. Some people may be living with individuals who have severe alcohol use disorder, both of them. So there's an additional environmental thing. And you could argue that vulnerability is, in a sense, an allergic kind of response. And that's how I would look at it. And so we know now that there are brain circuitry changes, that those traumas, those environmental factors challenge in the brain. So if you hype up your stress system, you're more likely to drink to cope with stress. If your frontal cortex is not working because of a whole bunch of reasons, trauma can do that. Maybe even, you know, a severe concussion from playing football as a 12-year-old could do that. We don't know. I mean, but, you know, let's speculate that you could have a concussion by skateboarding as a 12-year-old. I don't want to pick on football. But, the fact is that if your frontal cortex isn't working right, you may be very impulsive, which is going to lead you as a teenager to more likely to engage in drinking and other behaviors of that sort. And so I think you could call that an allergy, but I call it a vulnerability. And I would just translate the word from allergy to vulnerability, and I would link it up to brain structures. I mean, think of ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Those individuals are certainly much more likely to drink or even more so take stimulant drugs to self-medicate, okay? Because they already have a frontal cortex that maybe is a little out of whack or needs restructuring or retraining. And you know, some of that can occur. The earlier we pick up on some of these childhood vulnerabilities, the better is the treatment with extra attention and extra work in certain areas like cognitive therapy. So that's, I guess that's the way I would put it. How many research that connects binge drinking and heavy drinking to heart disease? Yes, there's a good bit of work out there. You can look not only on our website, but on the Heart Lung Institute's website, that heavy drinking and excessive drinking basically does to your heart what it does to your liver. All right. So I'm not an expert on this, but my division director, Kathy Young, could regale you with all the details. She's the director of metabolism and health effects of alcohol.
Dr. Koob, before you take another hand, I'm seeing Alan from Ireland waving his hand. Alan, would you unmute yourself?
Thank you, Greg. Dr. Koob, thank you so much. I found that most informative. With regards to allergies and magic bullets and special pills and whatnot, my understanding of alcoholism is that until the sufferer is prepared, number one, to recognize that they're in trouble and are prepared to do something about it, recovery cannot be imposed on an alcoholic. Our penal institutions have tried. It hasn't worked. Aversion treatment has been tried. It doesn't work. And if my brothers and sisters like myself, who came to the point, and generally a bad point in life as a result of excessive drinking, were prepared initially to do something about it. And I was very fortunate to meet people in Alcoholics Anonymous who supported and understood me. Very quick one. The Zoom meetings have been absolutely phenomenal. They've been an acid test. Again, it has concentrated the mind not only of the sufferer, but also of those people who are living in recovery. And I have seen a very positive response to the circumstances. And we, in our group, have people who are now 7 and 8 months sober and who are in service. We've supported them greatly. We also meet them outside of our houses and we go for coffee, etc. We also enjoy the privilege of getting people from around the world, United States and Canada, etc., to come to our groups, and we get a broader sense of experience in AA. Dr. Koob, thank you so much.
Well, that's very encouraging to hear, and thanks for those comments. And I couldn't agree more. I think one of the things we'd like to facilitate is having people who everyone looks up to in the health professional field do screening for alcohol use disorder. And I can tell you that I've been doing nothing. If I've been doing nothing during the pandemic with my institute directors, I'm trying to wedge alcohol questions into every cohort we're studying in NIH. So they're probably going to start getting mad at me soon. But nevertheless, we've been trying to get the audit C into every cohort in NIH to find out, you know, what exactly is going on, so we'll know, as you point out, where these vulnerabilities lie when we do start getting back together. So, you know, I totally agree, but a skilled doctor can ask two questions, you know, a primary care doc or a physician's assistant, just two questions, you know, how much do you drink and how much do your friends drink? And that can get things started, you know. We're also working, by the way, with the liver docs, very, very engaged with this now. And we're, in a sense, you could argue that some of the things they pick up, a liver doc picks up, could be a biomarker for alcohol use disorder. And so, you know, my dream is the same as Kevin Kuntz, who's but he's the power behind the scenes with ACAM, the organization that certifies addiction medicine specialists in the United States. You know, my dream is that someday we have, I got in trouble with using this word SWAT team because I guess it has negative connotations in the United States, but you know, that we would have a team that would descend on the emergency room like you have for a cardiovascular event. You go in and have a heart attack in the United States, there's a team of people that you're immediately connected with who do all the things that they're supposed to do to keep you from dying. We need the same thing when somebody shows up in an emergency room virtually unconscious from alcohol. And we need a team there that's going to move them into a treatment and that peace that you illustrated so well in what you said about they're going to need to want to fix the problem. They're going to want to change. I'm open to anything, Greg, and as long as you want, but I think it's gotten past the point where I can follow all the chat questions.
I understand, Dr. Kube.
If you want to save them, if your IT people can save the chat questions, you can send them to me an email. I'll do my best over time to answer.
Thank you. I will take you up on that, and I'll be in touch with your staff about that. We had scheduled the rest of this hour to talk about diversity in secular AA and forming new groups, not just about alcohol, but I know at least one person who wants to establish an Overeaters Anonymous secular program. And you're welcome to stick with us all day long, Dr. Kube. You have the schedule, but I know you're interested in diversity. And Joe, do we want to start that now, or do we want to?
Yeah, I think we can maybe blend. Dr. Kube was asking about people's experience with Zoom, and we'd love to hear about your experience with LGBTQ meetings, young people's meetings, women's meetings, just secular meetings, or any sort of recovery meetings overall. And if you want to slip in a question directly for Dr. Kube as we go through that, I know there's plenty more of those to come as well.
At 1 o'clock Eastern time, though, we do have another presentation scheduled for this room, although this room is supposed to hold 500 and it doesn't. So I'm not sure how we're going to treat that. Joe, do you have an answer?
I have a message into Zoom right now to find out why it's capping at 100 because we pay for 500.
Thank you. Yeah. Meanwhile, I'd like to hear who all is here from other places other than the United States, and particularly people who have formed special purpose AA groups. And if you have, you know, a brief description of that process. And I'm all in favor of just hollering out. Unmute yourself if you can.
I posted
Hello,
the link.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me?
Yes.
It's Sean here. I'm from the UK. I live in the Wrecking Beacons in Wales. Thank you very much for the meeting, and thank you very much, Dr. Kube. I'm Sean. I'm an alcoholic, I should say. Back in about 1980, I started a Heathens meeting in London, and we actually changed the name of it because the full title I wanted for it wouldn't fit into the headquarters database. So I called it Agnostics, Freethinkers, etc. And we closed the meeting after a few years. Like I told everybody, like we'd all become atheists, so we didn't bother anymore. I've been going to AA ever since. I kind of got sober and stayed sober in regular AA meetings, and I kind of took my own brand of atheism along there. Like, and they converted many people along the way. Like, I'm pleased to say, like I gave them license or legitimized their being non-believers. The wonders about Zoom is connected all us atheists up and non-believers. It's because I used to think like there's all sorts of wonderful atheist agnostics meetings in kind of the West Coast of America. Well, 2 or 3 years ago, like I was in San Francisco in 1980, I think, and there wasn't any there then. I was there 2 or 3 years ago, like, and I went to an atheist meeting, which wasn't actually on. I went to one in Seattle, which was a bit of a washout, like. So I went to some very good ones in New York, I would say, like. There was plenty of people there. But the thing about it now is that we're all connected up. And this is very important, that we're all connected up. We're not alone, and we can contact with each other. There's a wonderful list of meetings going around, worldwide list of secular AA meetings, like. And it helps us keep in touch with other. And it just it legitimizes how we feel, our feelings about this religion, God, etc. So I'll shortly be going back. We've got a little meeting here in our town. We'll be going back to that now at the beginning of next year. Like, we only get 6 or 8 people there. and it's wonderful. And but we'll be doing it on Zoom as well. It'll be a mixture. And that's what a lot of meetings will be going back to. So people who have got special needs, people who can't travel, etc., can come along, like people who are vulnerable, like especially because we're not going to be vaccinated for another 6 months or so. So it's a boom for that sort of thing, for minorities or for people who can't actually get to meetings, or people who went. I went to meetings in Colorado Springs, and I thought I was in the Little House on the Prairie. If I had have got sober in that, I would have been straight. If I had have gone there, first of all, I couldn't have connected to that at all. Like, you know, so I'm very pleased like that. We're connecting up now worldwide. Thanks to Zoom. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Sean. Someone else from elsewhere. Who's got a hand up?
Lucy.
Kathy.
No, I'm telling you that Lucy from the UK has her hand up.
Oh, sorry, I should have taken it down. I was going to ask Dr. Koob something, but we've moved on and I'm busy writing him an essay instead.
Hey, my name is Mikey. I'm an alcoholic. One thing that Zoom has brought us, my home group has a meeting, but then after the meeting, we have an informal beginners meeting where we're able to take some of the members aside that want to talk about, you know, beginners issues or how to get a sponsor, stuff like that, where we couldn't do that with our normal meeting. I think that's an advantage that Zoom has brought us, as opposed to as something that's unique to Zoom, not to mention, you know, we get a ton of people, and people always say how grateful they are. Same with the LGBT QAI meetings. A lot of people in certain places don't have those type of meetings to go to. And I think that's one of the things that makes Zoom so incredible. And Zoom does work because we have members that are now going on 8 or 9 months, and all they have done is Zoom meetings. They haven't done any regular face-to-face meeting. So I think other than the social part, and you don't hear as much laughter with everybody on mute, but basically the Zoom meetings really do seem to work. Thanks.
Thank you. Is Mario here? We have a gentleman who wanted to address us in Spanish this morning, and I don't know if he got into this room or not.
My name's Noe. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, everyone.
Hi, Noe.
Good morning. It's good to be here. And it's really, that was a really exciting talk by the doctor just before this. And I'm truly encouraged. Here in San Francisco, we have atheist, agnostic, free thinkers and others meetings 4 days a week, and a woman's meeting on top of that. And since Zoom, it's been wonderful to go all over the world. Someone suggested going to 50 meetings in 50 states in 50 days. I'm not that ambitious. But I also wanted to add that the Yale study, relapse prevention, pause, an article in Yale Study Medical on relapse prevention has been really beneficial to me and to people in our group. And so just keep, encourage everyone to keep coming back. And thank you for your support.
Yeah, I'm gonna answer Lucy's email, and then I'm going to say goodbye. Anybody else who wants to reach me, if you could go through Greg, I'm happy to answer as best we can. You know, some of these, I am really, really heartened to hear about how wonderfully the Zoom is working for AA. So keep up the good work and get as innovative as you can, and let us know about it.
So thank you, goodbye. Dr. Koob. Thank you very much. I think the rest of us, if you want to take 5 minutes, don't leave the room if you want to stay and hear the 1 p.m. It Came from the Kitchen with Maria Hornbacher and others.
I see that Mario's back in if he has his question in Spanish.
Oh, Mario, hello. Would you like to address the group in Spanish?
My name is Mario. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Mario. She's an alcoholic. Soy Mario. Soy un alcohólico.
Buenos días, Mario.
Soy también un alcohólico anónimo ateo. Quisiera darles la información que tenemos grupos de ateos y agnósticos. dos grupos, un grupo que lo conformamos muchos compañeros de América Latina, España, Australia. Tenemos reuniones los días lunes, miércoles, viernes, a las 7 de la noche, hora del este, hora de Nueva York. También tenemos reuniones los días jueves, reuniones de estudio, y utilizamos los libros seculares, especialmente el de Jeffrey Moore, sobre A sin Dios. También tenemos reuniones los días domingos a las 2 p.m., hora de Nueva York. Estas reuniones de los domingos son especiales porque estamos conectados a América y Europa. También tenemos otro grupo que se llama Paris Agnostic. Este grupo funciona los días sábados a las 11 a.m., hora del este, hora de Nueva York. Y estamos conformados por muchas nacionalidades. Yo soy alcohólico y llegué al programa de Alcohólicos Anónimos un 2 de diciembre del 2009. Esta semana cumplí 11 años. Me mantengo sobrio a través de la asistencia a los grupos hispanos aquí en la ciudad de Montreal, Canadá. Entonces, muchas gracias por este espacio. Y también quisiera aportar también a los compañeros, porque yo pertenezco a los grupos de ateos y agnósticos en francés. Moi aussi appartiens au groupe d'agnostique et athées. Ici, dans la région de Montréal, la province du Québec, il y a le groupe Les Libres Penseurs qui se réunit le mercredi et le dimanche à 7h, heure de Montréal. Ainsi que le groupe L'Union fait la force, c'est un autre groupe en langue française qui se réunit le jeudi à 7h30. Alors, c'est ça, mes amis. Thank you, Joe Sheldon.
Muchas gracias, Mario.
Muchas gracias a la conferencia secular de internacional. Gracias.
Thank you, Mario. I think we'll, those of you who want to join the other room, that's where I need to go. But if you want to stay in this room, just stay in this room. Does anyone need a link to the other room?
No, we need a link.
There's the link to the other room. It's called the Oh My God Room.
Our mostly agnostic group of drunks.
Thanks for listening to this audio version of the International Conference of Secular AA 2020. For more recordings, visit aasecular.org. There you will find resources, information on upcoming conferences, and plenty of audio from previous conferences as well. Thanks for listening.